From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Frac sand mining has been a contentious issue in recent years in western Wisconsin and southeastern Minnesota. Many people are concerned about a lack of regulation and threats that silica sand mining pose to air and water quality, and ultimately, the health of people who live in the region. Many of those concerns are being realized in parts of the country the sand is being exported to, where it's used with chemicals and water to extract natural gas reserves that are found thousands of feet underground through a drilling process known as fracking. Michelle Bamberger is a veterinarian, and Robert Oswald is a molecular medicine professor at Cornell University. They co-authored the book, The Real Cost of Fracking: How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food. It examines the impact fracking has on landowners and pets, primarily in the state of Pennsylvania. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Professor Oswald to describe how fracking works.
Gas drilling has been around for, you know, over 100 years, but the process of fracking actually started back in the 1940s in Oklahoma, where they drilled down and then they actually just cracked the rock to get more gas out. But the real advance, the really thing that has caused issues in some of the states that have it now is the what's called directional drilling with fracking, and that's where they go down and they turn the bit horizontally and then go about a mile and then use enormous volumes of chemicals, sand, and that's where the sand mining comes in, and water. They might use 5 million gallons of this fluid per well, per frack. And the idea, again, is to break open the shale layers. And let me say that the shale layers run horizontally, and that's why they can't do it with just drilling straight down, because they won't contact that much shale. So what they want to do is go into the layer and go horizontally. And they break it open with very high pressure, and they need the sand to keep the cracks open. And at that point, the gas flows back up into the wellhead, and they collect it along with a lot, millions of gallons of wastewater that they have to contend with.
This all seems like a very mysterious process. Not only the permitting, what's going on with the drilling, what's going on with the environment, what's going on with the health of people. Is permitting a pretty much cut and dried activity with this shale gas drilling?
Actually, it is. I mean, what has happened in many of the states, and you know, if you were to build a housing project or something, you might need to have an environmental impact statement. But what's done in most of these states is generate a generic supplemental or generic environmental impact statement. And what that does is it means that they don't have to have any environmental impact statement when they apply for a permit. And in fact, you know, if you compare the permitting process for a well to a permitting process for even putting solar panels on your house or certainly putting in a wind farm, it's much easier in many states. It's estimated in Pennsylvania it takes about 20 minutes.
Other things that happen after the permitting are a little, I guess the word I'd use would be less certainty over what happens with the environment, with the health of both people and animals.
There's lots of research coming out. It's an exponential amount of research that has been coming out in the last year. And that really speaks to the fact that we don't really understand this yet. If there's that much coming out, it's continually coming out more and more and more and more studies that we really don't understand the complexities of this. And when the public health is involved, it's really important to understand that.
What are some of the health issues for humans and animals?
Right. So what we have documented in our studies with humans, at least, have been pretty much acute impacts. And when I say acute, I mean we're talking about nosebleeds, headaches, rashes, gastrointestinal system problems like vomiting and diarrhea, rashes, you know, that sort of thing. I think if we follow out years after it started in a neighborhood, we might start to see some more chronic issues such as cancer, perhaps. So that's the sort of thing, when we refer to this as a health experiment going on, it really is. It's an experiment because we don't know what's actually going to be happening further down the line. As far as animals go, that's a pretty complex question, and that's because animals can sometimes be viewed as sentinels, because, especially food animals, because their exposure rates are higher, they have shorter generation times, they breed more often. We're going to be seeing that turnaround much faster than we would in say, a human population where the generation time is you know, 20 years or so. So with animals, what we saw in our initial study, where we looked at the largest number of animals that were affected per health category system, it was reproduction. And that was reproduction in both food animals and companion animals. We saw owners reporting other issues, rashes, GI issues with their neurological problems with their animals. But again, the greatest group or number of animals was in that category.
In your estimation, are the energy companies that are doing the drilling doing a good enough job working with landowners?
The answer to that is hard, because there are so many different companies, some of which are, you know, have a very good skill set and probably do a reasonable job. There are others that are kind of fly by night that don't do as well. But there are two issues. One is the drilling process itself. And certainly in the early years in Pennsylvania, they were contaminating aquifers simply by the drilling process, losing a lot of the drilling fluid into the aquifer, particularly when they hit a coal seam or something like that. Secondly is the well casings. They tend to leak after a certain length of time. They may be fine during the fracking process, but over time they start leaking, and it's hard to know what percent that is. The industry on offshore wells estimates about half the wells leak after, you know, 20 or 30 years. The second question is, are they doing a good enough job when there's contamination? Well, the industry line is that there's never been contamination, and it's always a contentious issue. In Pennsylvania, I'll give you one example, is that if there is any question, they have to supply water to people within, I believe it's 1,000 feet of the well. But they do that and state that it's not their fault. So there, I don't know of any time when the industry has actually admitted that they've contaminated water.
I think I would also add to that that, you know, if testing is done, what Robert just said, within 1,000 feet, and it doesn't appear, comparing pre-drilling to post-drilling tests, that they are responsible, then I would question whether they really do have to supply water, because we've had several cases where the state regulatory agency has deemed that while there is no problem here, that your water supply given to you by the drilling company can be cut off because it's showing in tests that they are not responsible. So we are going to, you know, pull that away from you. And that has...
So we'll have a debate here. Actually, the state law says that they have to give the water initially, but then they can take it back after a certain length
okay,
of time.
Okay, so that makes sense.
Apart from the water issues, what are some other environmental problems we're seeing with frack drilling?
Air issues have become really important, and that's an interesting question that you asked, John, because we did a follow-up study that was a 25-month follow-up on average of our cases. And what we started to see with that was a lot more air exposures. Compressor stations have to be put in to move the gas along, and because there's starting to be a buildup, there are more compressor stations. And compressor stations, as part of what they do emit a volatile organic compounds into the air and other chemicals that will contaminate the air. So people living around those areas are starting to have air exposures and feel respiratory issues. We know this with the animal a part of the whole thing. We saw, again, getting back to food animals as having the highest exposure, that we saw an increase in respiratory issues. And we also saw an increase in growth problems, so failure to thrive and stunting, especially in the cattle farmers telling us that their calves are not growing as well. And we thought that this was very interesting in light of several studies that have come out done on babies living in intensively drilled areas compared to babies that are not living in intensively drilled areas, and seeing problems with birth defects and small for gestational age and low birth weights. So we thought, well, you know, this is an interesting finding, especially in light of what we're seeing with our few cases on animals.
It seems like a lot of this stuff is just real hard to track. For example, I think of the companies in the book, you see they're spraying their wastewater on dirt roads to keep the dust down from the traffic they create. And animals are sometimes drinking from the ponds of wastewater, and it affects them right away. How do you prove something like that?
No, that's a really good point. Well, we've observed it with our own eyes, actually. In Pennsylvania, and actually the proposal is in New York as well. We keep referring to Pennsylvania and New York, but that's what we know the best. The law says that they can spread wastewater on the roads for desalting, for dust control, et cetera. It's supposed to be tested. It's not supposed to have organic compounds in it. It's not supposed to have radioactive material in it, et cetera. That's probably what we have seen has not followed that based on our smell test, at least. We know it's some that we've noticed had quite a bit of organics in it. It's hard to regulate. It's done in a way a lot of times where it's kind of clandestine. You can't have a regulator everywhere. The other problem is, one can get an idea of what they use in their hydraulic fracturing fluid, but you don't always know what comes up from the shale layers. There's some work now to try to figure out some signature compounds so we can prove that, this water that's been put on the road illegally, actually came from a well. But up to now, that's been a very difficult thing to do.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking with Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald. They are co-authors of the book, The Real Cost of Fracking, How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food. The book is largely a snapshot, anecdotes of what's going on in Pennsylvania, and I know you're familiar with what's going on in New York, but similar circumstances are occurring around the country, I assume.
Our cases in the first study came from as far away as Colorado, Texas, Louisiana, several states where this is occurring, even in Ohio. The second study also included North Dakota and Arkansas. So it is happening all over in many different parts of the country. We hope that more researchers will get involved in looking at the health impacts. But as you state, it really is hard to get a handle on this. And that's why we're hoping that at least at the state level and even the federal level, that they will pick this up and start doing, a large health impact assessment.
And just let me say that this is not just our country. We're exporting this technology to other countries. We've talked to people in many places, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, England. It's going quite a bit. They're doing quite a bit of it in Poland. So it's something that's really worldwide, and there are people that are having, concerns worldwide.
Could you, one of you, explain, I guess, the process of reaching a contractual agreement with these landowners to do this drilling on their property? Because it's my understanding that in most cases we don't talk about this type of agreement that's part of that. And you're able to talk to the people you talk to in the book because they did not have agreements, or they did not have leasing agreements with the companies?
No, they all had leasing agreements with the company, and that's well known. I think some of the problems have come in because people have signed leases without going to lawyers, so they didn't always understand everything in the lease. And the lease is actually written by the company, so it really gives the company most of the priority, and the people, it's very difficult, for example, to get out of one of the leases.
So I would also add, John, that we have an assortment of different types of people in situations. So some people didn't lease at all, and nothing to do with it. So they are neighbors to this process and are being affected. So that's one. The other thing is there are people who bought land that had the mineral rights already leased. So they're in that situation. There are people that have bought land where both the surface and mineral rights have been leased. There was part of the house sale. So there are all different kinds of agreements there with that. I think almost, and tell me if you were alluding to the non-disclosure agreements on that. And right, and so when that happens, we are cut off completely. We do believe that that has happened in one of the cases in the first study, and that was the only case where the owners never returned my calls, where I had heard from other people involved with that case that they had signed off for payment for all those the cattle that were lost, for all damages, and they were not speaking to anyone. So I can't tell you literally that they signed a non-disclosure agreement, but I suspect that that is what happened. And when that happens, we are cut off to a certain point of knowing exactly where that trail ended.
What has fracking meant for energy policy in the U.S.?
It's been a big deal. I mean, certainly that's part of Obama's all-of-the-above energy policy. It's been thought that one of the reasons we should do this is because natural gas is a so-called clean-burning fuel. That is actually true if you're just looking at burning it. What the contention comes in is that there are quite a few leaks. In fact, there was just recently a peer review publication that showed that the leaks were much worse than anybody ever expected. So the question is it really better than coal? Coal is pretty terrible, but is it even any better than coal? And I think the jury's still out on that. But in any event, I think that we probably will become a net exporter of natural gas and perhaps a net exporter of oil before too long because of that.
Are the lower gas prices we're seeing now a result of the fracking that we're seeing around the country?
One could argue that. I think in general, the prices that we pay are manipulations by Wall Street. If natural gas prices that are close to historic lows, and they're working as, and that probably is because of the glut of natural gas. I think what's going to happen, however, is there's such an effort now to export it. So they're trying as hard as they can to increase the price by exporting it, decreasing our domestic supply, so that we pay more and they make more money.
Do you, too, believe the public health and environmental problems that you talk about in the book are worth cheaper energy, I guess, in the long run?
I don't believe it is. We can't afford to keep going on using fossil fuels for the climate. That's become extremely obvious to everyone. I'll say almost everyone. There are still some climate deniers. But, you know, we are ruining our planet that way and much faster than we can afford to do. So we really have to aggressively move off all fossil fuels, including shale gas and tight oil, all unconventional fossil fuels, and move rapidly towards renewables. I think if we keep allowing the infrastructure to be put in for gas, all these compressor stations and these export terminals, then we will be stuck in that groove of fossil fuels for years, because people are going to, of course, choose the lower or cheaper option for their payments for energy, rather than saying, okay, I'll pay a little bit more, I'll put some more in for a cleaner energy, a cleaner planet like solar or wind.
Let me just add one thing to that that's really, I think, is a really important point. And one of the things that we always hear is that renewables have to be subsidized. The reason they're subsidized is because the oil and gas industry has been subsidized for the last 150 years. And by historical standards, compared to the oil and gas industry, renewables are getting much less in the way of subsidies. And in fact, the International Monetary Fund calculated that if you consider all externalities, the oil and gas industry worldwide in 2011 has been subsidized by $2 trillion.
Frack sand mining in our region is just a small percentage of what goes into the mining in other parts of the country for natural gas. Do you have any thoughts on what's happening with sand mining in our region and how many of their concerns are similar with what we see between the sand mining and the gas extraction in other parts of the country?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. And as I looked into frack sand mining and of course, knowing what we know about the fracking issue, I did see a lot of similarities. And the one to start with would be industrialization of the landscape. So they are similar. You've got these operations next to farms, next to homes, next to schools, next to churches. They're right there in the community, right amongst us. They're not separated by any means. They operate 24/7, so there's noise, there's truck traffic, and there's light pollution. So those are exactly the same. There are water issues. So there's water that's used in the processing of the sand and the washing of the sand, just as there's water used in fracking operations also. In both cases, there are starting to be closed-loop systems and recycling used, which certainly helps to cut down on the water use. However, we have to keep in mind that this is fresh water that's being used and that's being removed from the fresh water cycle and that's being contaminated. So that's a big factor. I think the other issue is air, and that, of course, is very big with the frac sand mining issue as well as with fracking. But I think with the frac sand mining issue, there's also probably a more urgency there because of the threat of silicosis and the silica dust in the air. How far does that travel? We know that the silica dust of 2.5 microns in diameter or less can cause many health problems. It can cause lung cancer. It's a carcinogen. It can cause COPD and increase the risk of heart failure, lung disease, and kidney disease. It's a very complex process, but in silicosis, of course. So that is a huge issue. And beyond that, for me as a veterinarian, I know that sand is used in cow bedding. And what I have heard is that these fines that are the waste product of the sand processing are used by farmers in Wisconsin and Minnesota, probably other states where it's available, to be used for their cows. Now, that is no problem if it's the proper size sand. So that's the first issue. The sand may be too small in diameter, and if that is the case, then it won't allow proper drainage or it won't allow proper support for the cow. But the other issue is if that sand is washed with polyacrylamide, which is a flocculant that's used in processing, the polyacrylamide will contain small amounts of acrylamide. And even though there's small amounts, acrylamide is a very potent neurotoxin. It's also a skin and respiratory irritant. And so I worry as a veterinarian for the sake of the cows and the milk that they're producing and the food, but also for the farmers who have to put that sand into the stalls and, what are they possibly being exposed to? So those, I think I brought up a lot of issues here now. How do we deal with that? We feel that monitoring should be done, and I know there is some monitoring being done already, at least in Wisconsin and Minnesota. But the monitoring has to be continuous. It's not a sort of thing where we do a study over a certain period of time, everything looks okay, and then we stop. I think it has to be continuous because the industry is becoming more intensive, because things change over time, weather changes, wind. So it really should be continuous, and we should be able to detect at the proper levels. So for instance, with acrylamide, the maximum contaminant level on that is 0.5 micrograms per liter. That's in the part per billion range. We have to be able to detect that. Again, with the silica dust, we have to be really looking for 2.5 microns in diameter or less, not put out filters or monitors that are not going to be able to detect that.
Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald co-authored the book, The Real Cost of Fracking: How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food. They spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis when they visited UW-La Crosse in late October. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Mian Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.